First they think you're crazy, then they fight you, and then all of a sudden you change the world.
Health and biotech news, a tech bro or sis would find kind of interesting.
We're here to celebrate the completion of the first survey.
On the advice of counsel, I will not be giving an opening statement.
Of the entire human genome.
Okay guys, so let's do how ChatGPT is more empathetic than human doctors. And then we'll also do how AI is beating doctors at diagnosis left, right, and center. So on the first story, this is a really popular paper that came out in JAMA Internal Medicine, which is a huge medical journal, and it's been hitting headlines basically saying that ChatGPT is now more empathetic than humans. So they did something really interesting. They go on Reddit. There's this subreddit called Ask Docs, where people post questions and doctors, usually in America, answer them.
Have you ever answered a question on this subreddit?
No, I don't know anything about medicine, so I don't know why you would do that in your spare time anyway. It seems to probably open you up to some medical legal risk. And yeah.
That's the question. It compares ChatGPT answers to answers posted by these doctors who suspiciously like to spend their free time answering people on Reddit. So, I mean, question about like what type of doctor spends their time doing that. But it could be in the person's favor, because maybe it's just the type of doctor that's really empathetic and really, you know...
Yeah.
I think we take it for granted, though, that people have access to, like, healthcare, that they don't have to decide between dinner and speaking to a doctor. I mean, in the US, I know that's not the case.
Yeah. So essentially, they look at those questions posed by people on Reddit and they compare two things. So they compare the answer that the doctors gave on Reddit, the human doctors, and then they also feed those questions into ChatGPT and generate a response. And then they get a panel of human doctors and they say which one of these responses were more empathetic and which were just generally more accurate and just gave better medical advice. And it turns out that the ChatGPT was way more empathetic and the responses were just of better medical quality as well.
Yeah,
and
not just empathetic. They were three times more likely to be judged as good or very good, and they were 10 times more likely to be more empathetic.
Absolutely.
The ChatGPT answers.
So what do you guys think of this?
Is this an untrained, like, chat? It's nothing. It's just out of the box ChatGPT.
Yeah, out of the box. I think it was ChatGPT 3.5 as well. It wasn't even the newer version.
Awesome. Okay, interesting.
I mean, as a study, I think it's really interesting. Shows that a lot of what doctors do can be automated. But there's a few issues here. I mean, first of all, as we said, like, we're comparing doctors on Reddit that are posting publicly, they are taking time out of their day. So these aren't really answers that you would give to your patient at a clinic, perhaps. So maybe the comparison isn't that fair, but also they might be junior doctors. There might be, you know, there's a lot of nuance here, but there's also this this thing of the panel judging. Did they actually not know the difference between a ChatGPT answer and a physician answer?
Adam, I want to pick up on this point because they are technically blinded, as in they're just comparing two answers.
Yeah, no way you can blind the ChatGPT answer. Like, that's
exactly
impossible.
The ChatGPT answers were longer, that there were 200 words on average versus the physician responses, which were 50 words. And there's a specific tone a ChatGPT answer has. You can spot it a mile off. So this wasn't blinded. And secondly, the people judging the answers were the authors of the papers and were doctors. So these are AI zealot doctors who probably want this to work. They're probably people like us who are really pro-tech. And they're the ones who are the judges, you know, judge and jury as well. So I don't think this was a very good study, to be honest.
We wouldn't dispute the point that doctors around the world are slammed. In some markets, they're slammed because public healthcare systems are overloaded. In other countries, they're slammed because they're just packing as many in because there's a profit motive or what have you. So if you have a piece of software that can get to the right reasoning, but can take its time because there's no opportunity cost really for like generating another 200 or 400 characters to explain the condition in more detail, to give more empathetic management plan, then it doesn't actually surprise me that you're going to get more thoughtful responses.
Yeah, but I mean, it was judged by physicians saying the responses sounded more empathetic. Does that just mean more jargon, useless words that are just kind of filler words?
It's called care, mate. care.
No, because I would like to know if
doctor
patients
of the
would
container.
Have a similar experience.
I used to think it's what
I would
makes
like
us
to know
human,
if a patient had
maybe not.
A similar experience. I would like to know if the patient would rank ChatGPT responses more empathetic. maybe that's not actually what people care about. Maybe they just want a short answer that is to the point. Maybe empathy isn't really what you're looking for when you're asking something online. Empathy is more something that you get at the bedside.
My point is that for me, the empathy piece is not surprising. The piece that's continually amazes me is the accuracy and validity of the response. The reason the empathy is not surprising is I use ChatGPT for maybe a dozen times a day for like educational use cases. I'm trying to understand something. ChatGPT is far more patient, responsive, comprehensive. It never exhausts. It doesn't get frustrated. If I don't understand, I say, explain it again. Give me another analogy. Like as a parent, if I'm doing like, you know, teaching my kids, or as a student, when I had teachers of my own, if I stood there at the front of the classroom or after a class and asked a series of questions in the same way that I do of this technology, person would be like, dude, like go to the library, get a book, Google search, ask your peers, like stop asking me these questions. So these technologies are designed to cater to our needs in that way. So for me, that's
so interesting.
Not surprising.
When I hit that point with ChatGPT, I often feel like I have this feeling where I'm like pushing it too far. I'm like, I'm being an asshole here.
Do you say please and thank you?
I do.
You do? Okay, good, good.
Really? You don't say it in real life, Adam.
I do, yeah.
But no, I want to build on Adam's earlier point, because it's when you are a patient, I think that you want someone who is cool, confident, and doesn't necessarily give you all the fluff and all this empathy. Sometimes I just want someone who gives me some certainty, says, look, you probably have a chest infection, go do this and you'll be fine. ChatGPT, when I was looking at the examples they gave in the paper, the responses are kind of like those ones where it's very medically legally safe. So it's like, you know, you could have this or you could have that and guidelines say this and you'll probably be fine. And on the Reddit forum, I find the answers are a lot more straight to the point. They're like, dude, you'll be fine. It doesn't, you know, you're not spiking a fever. You don't need to go to hospital. Just watch it for the next few days. And I prefer those responses. So I'd be really interested to see what patients would think of this.
Exactly. And I mean, this is pitched as something that will save costs, right? But will it actually, or will it increase costs? It's similar to, because everything is being safeguarded, or because it's going to be played safe.
If the follow-up is like you get escalated to ChatGPT-5, when it's like when there's a clinical equipoise, then that's not going to cost anything. So I think it's a fair question. Like, you know, how does this fit into a patient pathway, and where does the triaging happen, and where does the cost sit? But I think we're moving more and more. I mean, we're going to talk about some of these papers later in terms of the diagnostic abilities of AI being multimodal. It's not just what you type into a box on Reddit, but it's, you know, what your webcam on your computer, what it can find by taking a picture of your face, for example. So I think we're moving in that direction where more and more of this is going to be handled computationally.
Yeah, Imran, but Adam's point is, I think it's excellent, which is that, for once, which is that if this technology is playing it overly cautious and it's overly sensitive and it's, you know, sending everyone to the ED or A&E, then are the costs downstream going to exceed whatever cost you're saving? Because we've seen this as well with telemedicine as well. I know that's your area of expertise, Imran. But we found that the big promise was that, okay, you can just FaceTime your doctor, get the treatment over the phone.
Yeah, no cost
they don't need
savings.
To do a physical visit. Exactly. And then we found that when they've actually done the cost effectiveness, what actually happens is that people are just using that service way more, people who are younger, healthier.
Yeah, well, also because the physician on the telemedicine service doesn't know you. So a lot of the rapidity in primary care and the efficiency of care, if you speak to physicians, it will say, because I've known Mary for 30 years. I knew her when she got breast cancer. I was there with her when she got treated, and I know, you know, I've been with her since, and I know the psychological impact, so I can counsel her very quickly in a rapid consultation. A new doctor has to kind of digest all that history. But I think you're looking at a near-term state when you see the cost increase. I think with the pace of adoption, you're going to see new technologies that we can't even imagine today entering the ER, for example. And it used to be a joke in the US back in the day, as soon as you entered the ER, you got a whole body MRI. Now it's going to be something that has almost zero marginal cost, like some biomarker data that's been collected from your body continuously, integrated with your EMR record history, integrated with some emotional analysis of, and, you know, real-time vitals that are taken from a camera, like PPG, you know, your heart rate, maybe your blood pressure, oxygenation. And you're going to get triaged. You're going to be constantly triaged. That's where the future is going. I think it's going to be in the same way that the predictive power of your online behavior and buying some purple t-shirt you don't need from a website you never heard of, it's going to be the same types of technologies that are going to predict your clinical course. So I think it's going to drive costs up is an intermediate state.
Yeah, I mean, could be. We don't know, really. But my takeaway to bring it back down to earth is that it shows basically that the basic response has now gone up to a level where it's actually pretty good compared to no response that most people are used to. Most people don't have access to a GP on text. So if your basic level is access to ChatGPT, that's
pretty good
that we're there now. And also it's not either or. It's not a doctor's opinion versus ChatGPT. I think these tools will evolve to become. I mean, we have these now. Most doctors use UpToDate, use clinical decision tools. They're just going to be even better and assist doctors make those decisions. I mean, I've done this with patients in my clinic. I would look up something while they're with me. We'll Google it together, yeah. Right? But I'm there to provide context. I'm there to provide assurance and supervise the whole thing. But
let me ask you a question, which is about unwarranted variations in healthcare. So there's a kind of romantic idea that physicians are artists more than call center operators. And there's a kind of nuance and a specificity and a flair in the individual practice. And there's another paradigm, which is that no, unwarranted, unexplained variations in the management and care decisions of a doctor are actually bad for a system because they create unpredictability, they create bad outcomes. And you see that particularly where there's a cost agenda, which is being pursued, like around use of surgery to treat knee arthritis, hip arthritis. People have looked at differences in rates. They've looked at differences in rates of cardiac procedures where physicians own the diagnostic facilities or they own certain things where they're incentivized to do more diagnosis, more intervention. So could these types of technologies that, we're joking about the kind of 200 words bang on response for every single answer. Could this be a way to actually drive out some of the unwarranted variations in care? And I wonder if that's going to be something which hits certain specialties differently to others.
It'll definitely hit certain specialties different. But what happens is it's like standardizing care and evidence-based medicine. What happens is you improve the baseline, you improve the average, but you might actually decrease the level of care when it comes to those highly specialized areas.
Well, the very valid solution to this seems to be that you just cap the bottom. So you have variation between physicians, but you just cap it so that no one's being unsafe, no one's doing anything crazy. And maybe that's where insurance policies come in, like ChatGPT or whatever, and guidelines come in. And then you allow that variation, which involves really, really good care.
Yeah, I can get behind that. I think that there's two ways of looking at it. One is preventing harm and ensuring safety. And another is forcing all clinicians into a very narrow type of practice. And I think the former will be much more readily accepted, at least by the practitioners, maybe not the people who are hiring them and running the healthcare systems. But I think on the front lines, most people, I think if I was practicing and someone said, hey, I've got this aid that will make you a bit safer and catch out any red flags in your practice, do you want to use it? I would say yes.
There is an issue with ChatGPT, especially that it hallucinates studies and it hallucinates data sometimes.
Yeah.
And this is a big issue with using these tools as a clinical decision aid. They haven't really solved this. And it seems to be an issue of it's still not as good as a human in reading medical literature and translating it into something tangible. There's a whole reason why that is. But the solution might be to rewrite and reorganize existing medical literature into a way that is easier for machine learning algorithms to read.
Yeah. It's not just about ChatGPT, right? So Google has this, is it called MedPalm? MedPalm 2, something like that? This algorithm, which is healthcare specific, which performed 85% or something on the medical licensing exams. So that probably would perform better than ChatGPT. I think what I would love to see is a confidence interval on a response or a reference. So let's say ask a question. I asked a question today about a company's drug pipeline, which is a factual question. So now I have an intuition when I need to double check. So I've built my own internal algorithm, which is this is a query that I need to fact check. So I asked it the question and then I found that it kind of hallucinated the indications and the scale of the clinical pipeline of this company. So it said it had 100 programs in the clinic. The top three were in cancer and something else. It's actually got 12 drugs in the clinic, 12 drugs in the clinic, in the pipeline, and there were different indications. So I think if you could get that type of intuition, because I will be missing factual errors in my use of the interface, if you could get that type of intuition baked in and as a feedback to the user, I think that'd be super helpful.
What I'm saying is there might be a business case or a business opportunity here to kind of translate medical literature into a way that is easier for machine learning algorithms to understand. And if you have that data, I think, because I think this is going to be regulated at some point on the level of kind of preventing machine learning algorithms to train themselves. And
yeah,
because you don't want two levels of training where you lose the kind of trace of where the data is coming from.
So there are companies that are doing this. Like there's one called BioRelate, which is a UK-based company, and there's another one called Causally, which is, I think, backed by Index Ventures, which are trying to basically, you know, I guess, bring understanding to the medical literature and connect ideas and concepts and infer causality and, you know, link different types of publications that might be using different terminology to talk about the same underlying concept. So I think people are trying to solve this. I don't know what the state of the art is, and I don't know how close it is to being done.
Okay, cool. Shall we move on?
Yeah.
So, move on.
Imran, you had these two studies about how AI is beating doctors left, right, and center at diagnosis. Do you want to go over them?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about these two papers, I'm going to describe them briefly, is that when we were trained as physicians, I mean, my own experience was that there was a huge emphasis put on clinical skills. So, you know, classic case, you walk into the patient's room on a cardiac ward, the consultant stands at the back of the room and there's just like pin drop silence. He tells everyone to be quiet and he's like, what's the condition? And if you're listening carefully, you hear the mechanical heart valve, you know, you see the top of the scar at the top of the patient's dressing gown, and you know, you sort of piece together the story, or you see the kind of black toe, and you're sort of figuring out like what's going on here, that this is a, you know, a valve infection that was treated with a valve replacement, and then you start seeing the medications on the shelf, and you're kind of using this sort of clinical reasoning. These two papers, they are examples of deep learning algorithms that use exactly the same signal that human beings' own sensory systems have access to. So we're not talking about radiological imaging. We're not talking about pathology. We're not talking about recognizing things that, you know, we're just not true. We're literally talking about the things that we've grown up with, our sensory, you know, the things that we pay attention to. So the first is pictures of the external eye. This was a study from Google Health, and they looked at basically 150,000 patients in the US that had been through diabetic screening centers. So these centers take large volumes of patients and they screen them by taking pictures of the back of the eye and a couple of other things, to monitor their progression, or the presence or progression of what's called diabetic retinopathy, so eye damage due to diabetes. The other paper looked at people's speech, and different to other types of biomarker technologies in the past that listen to the sound of your speech and the pauses and the raspiness of your voice or whatever it may be, this actually looked at the structure of the language, so your choice of words, sequencing of words, and so on, which is what large language models are particularly good at. Both of these studies found like superhuman diagnostic capabilities. So in the eye imaging, external eye imaging studies, what they found is that the pictures of the external eye of patients, for example, just with pupil dilatation taken with a regular camera, so nothing fancy, they could basically predict pretty reliably the presence of diabetic retinal disease. So they're not looking at the retina. They're not using any special equipment to look in the back of the eye or anything like that. They're literally just looking at the face of the patient.
So is this like an iPhone photograph of someone's face or
exactly,
eye?
Exactly.
It's
pretty basic. And the area under the curve of the, which is basically a measure of the
accuracy.
Power, predictive power, yeah, and accuracy of this approach was like 85% for diabetic retinal disease. And also much better than basically just taking a simple history and demographics of the patient and other things that are used commonly in sort of screening settings. So this means that we're basically getting to the point where like consumer technologies can detect biomarkers of disease at population scale using things like an iPhone. In the case of the language study in Alzheimer's disease, what they found is that just looking at people's speech and patterns of speech, they could determine and predict the basically presence of early stage Alzheimer's disease. So basically what they found is that if you mix people with like early Alzheimer's with healthy controls, they can actually pick out the patients with Alzheimer's disease. And secondly, they can infer their cognitive testing results, which would normally be done with a physician or a nurse on a kind of standardized score. They can infer that basically from what the patient's saying. Yeah, so what is the role? I guess this is interesting because there's like, it calls into question, I think, the ongoing role of the physician as a diagnostician. And is starting to point at, you know, superhuman.
On this Alzheimer's study, I'm always skeptical. I always see these early detection or early screening of Alzheimer's type papers. And then the next question is always, well, what's the point? Because we don't have good treatments in place for Alzheimer's. And with any screening or early diagnosis, you need to know, okay, can we detect it? Cool. And then the next part is, can we do something about it? So, okay, large language model can pick up Alzheimer's in this cool way, but what's the point?
Yeah, so I think it's just an example of like how AI is coming for doctors' jobs. And like, I don't know what your takes are on how this technology makes it into clinical workflows. Like, where does it come from? Which piece of software or which piece of hardware is it embedded in? And does it start to eat away incrementally at the role of the physician? So I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts on like, is this actually going to hit clinics? When's it going to happen? How's it going to manifest?
I mean, of course it will. But the thing is, like, how many tools do we use now in clinic? Like, can you do anything without any tools? You can't. And has the doctor's role diminished? It hasn't really. It's just changed over time. You just learn how to use these tools, interpret them, explain the results to the patient, and follow up with them. The role of the physician isn't just diagnosis. Actually, it's probably like a very small part of the physician's role.
So if you look at the Google example of imaging the external eye, I think there's tons and tons of research that's been underway. There are actually, I can't really name that many examples that are in routine clinical practice yet. So that's what I'm trying to tease apart is like, how do these technologies actually hit the clinic? I take your point. Obviously, people are going to keep using tools. I think one thing I've seen recently is I think some of the large language models that have been developed at Google have been made available through API access on Google Cloud. I saw a news release about that recently. There was a joint press release between Google and I think Accenture or Deloitte saying that they were like a consulting partner to help their customers who are using their cloud services now integrate these new APIs that have these healthcare large language models into routine activity. But I'm still interested as to like what the use cases will be. Like, when will we see it? When will we encounter it? Like, where will that first pop up into a workflow?
And I guess what I was trying to get at is the real impact will be, I mean, why are we training physicians for like tens of years to become consultants when like a lot of what we're training people in is kind of becoming obsolete? Like when you do your MRCP PACES exam, it's one of the most difficult exams in the world to become an internal medicine physician. You basically are training your own algorithms in detection of these little signs and little marks here and there. Once you're done, you're never going to use these probably again with the advance of these tools. I think medical training needs to evolve. I think we can cut it in half. A doctor should become a consultant in a few years.
We can probably you'd be a consultant by
2 years.
Then.
I would be, unfortunately.
Wow, that's scary.
Maybe I'm a bit biased.
So I think we've talked before about like Microsoft teaming up with an EHR company. Which one was it, Musty? Was it Epic?
Epic.
To bring some of these LLMs into healthcare. But I think like obviously there are startups that are active in healthcare that are being used by clinicians. So for example, in the UK, we have companies like AccuRx, which are being used extensively by primary care physicians for communication use cases that have integrations into the medical record system. In terms of the surface area of a physician's day, I think that's like one part of the surface area that might start to evolve very quickly. But there's another example. I was sort of just noodling on this earlier, which is that so many healthcare systems are under tremendous pressure in terms of like not having enough staff, staff increasingly, you know, seeking early retirement, or in this country, we're seeing people migrate for economic reasons. I think I saw a statistic the other day that the numbers of UK graduates are now 1 in 7 leaving to other countries to continue practicing. And then you've also got the ongoing conversation about the doctor's pay and the threat of strikes. Is there a world where a payer, and in the UK, the payer is the government, but in the US and other markets, the payer could be private enterprise. Is there a world where a payer actually puts $1, $2 billion of R&D money behind a project to actually, you know, automate part of a clinician's reasoning, because actually they're paying the staff of the they're paying the salaries of those clinicians. They're having to deal with all of the like human stuff like sick leave, holidays, and then they're having to deal with, we talked about unwarranted variation earlier, medical safety issues. Like, why bother? You know, why that this technology is so advanced now. Why not, like, cut your physician? I'm just playing devil's advocate.
The obvious use case for this is, I think the most clinical need is probably in rare disease. We've got the diagnostic odyssey where someone with a rare disease can take 7 to 10 years to get diagnosed, right? And I know in the grand scheme of things, maybe financially it's not as big of a deal, but that seems to be where these LLMs could really come out, where it's like this really nebulous set of, like, family history, clinical symptoms, genetics, etc. And that is some real house stuff that I think LLMs would be really cool for.
Yeah. It's nibbling away at that diagnostic, the art of, or the diagnosis. There's also a really funny case on Twitter of someone who diagnosed their dog with an LLM. He had this like condition that they couldn't treat, and they put it into ChatGPT, and it gave them a diagnosis, and then it was treated. So it's not just for humans.
Imran, I think you've not really talked about the most interesting part of these two papers. So basically, your first paper is, can we take images of someone's eye and detect diabetic eye disease? And then your second one is, can we detect Alzheimer's based on the way someone speaks, right? I think the most interesting thing about AI here is that we're taking data that we think is a big nothing. So it's just our speech data, or it's just like an iPhone picture of our eye. And what is AI coming out with? It's just phenomenal. So the other paper that comes to mind, it was published in Lancet Digital Health, I think last year, where they fed in black and white x-rays, like chest x-rays of people. Mm-hmm. And the AI with amazing results was able to predict the race of the person. So it could tell if you were black, brown, yellow, white, etc., just on a black and white chest x-ray, which no human can do, by the way. And it's totally impossible, but the AI was able to do it. So
yeah,
I think the actual implication for this is also just to be careful with what data you're putting out there. I mean, we're doing a podcast with video as well. So I don't know what people will be able to diagnose us with in 100 years. But it's, I think that's like the phenomenal part of this. It's just like what kind of insights this is making.
What we're doing now is we're bringing these like moderate to high IQ people, training them for years and years on developing their own algorithms in one specific area of medicine until they become proficient enough to diagnose and do all of this stuff. We're actually taking away a lot of IQ diverting away from problems that are probably more suited to a lot of people who are in medicine. So I think this is a good thing in general.
I think like somebody once described it to me like this, like you can spend your life like taking problems that are solved and being part of the distribution of that solution to greater populations. So let's say, for example, management of diabetes is a solved problem, but we need more physicians to see all the patients with diabetes, right? Or you can take your life and you can say, management of diabetes is a solved problem to this level of primary prevention and secondary treatment. But if you spend your life working on that problem, you might actually be able to move the state of the art forward incrementally. So that's a kind of different type of contribution to mankind, womankind.
Yes.
And so I think this type of technology enables the first use case quite well, which is how do we take the collective human intelligence and actually create something called super intelligence out of, because there's no one in the world that can look at an x-ray and determine the race, gender, age, etc., with like confidence intervals. But a computer can do that on collective human intelligence by this emergent super intelligent behavior. So how do we like get those problems solved by the computers and then use computers, but also human ingenuity to solve the frontier problems where we can only ever advance to a certain level? So that's my way of like understanding what you have just described.
And I guess, Adam, your point was that you think doctors aren't actually that, or doctors are smart people, but there's smarter or more difficult problems they could be working on. And these kinds of technologies might enable them to work on the more creative, higher yield.
It's a black hole. Medicine is a black hole for talent and intelligence.
Okay.
Oh my gosh. Okay. These views do not represent the views of my employer, et cetera, et cetera. So like, let's go back to this question of like, would a payer fund like an AI GP or like nurse practitioner or even cardiologist or metabolic disease like protocol patient medication manager, if that was a thing? Imagine, so the NHS obviously has like technology. I'm just taking an example of the NHS here, but this is probably applicable to payers across the world. There are technology teams within that system, and the payer system also has relationships with like elite top tier technology services providers, and in some cases also some of the big tech companies. They have commercial relationships with parts of those businesses that contain the world's greatest cloud compute resources and the world's most powerful APIs to input a string of patient queries and output like a response. So for, when I think this through, like all of the building blocks are actually there, right? All of the pieces are there for a payer to say, you know, we're actually not going to hire that many doctors in 20 years, 10 years time, because actually we're going to create our own solution to the problem of
managing. You just need to show that A, it's safe, and B, it's cost effective. Is that just the jigsaw that needs to be sort of the
puzzle? Yeah, I don't know. I actually don't know. I think there's probably something else around like the social, in countries where it's like publicly funded healthcare, the social contract we have as citizens with the state to provide healthcare, and like feeling like we need to see a human being and a physician, that may hamper the, a bit like the ethnic minority patients today that don't speak very good English go to a physician that doesn't reflect them and get worse care. The squidgy human population that has like ailments goes to the machine and feels like I'm not getting the right care. There'll be some translation of that same problem, but with different actors in the relationship.
Okay, let's wrap up then with some audience feedback.
Yeah, so... I actually wanted to jump in. We probably won't have time to run this one now, but there was an article in Sifted by Tessa Clark, a really interesting, catchy headline, which is founders need to take a stand against VC's dirty money. And the subheading is the anonymity of the sources of VC funding can raise ethical concerns. Here's why founders should be more inquisitive about investments. The article is basically talking about where VCs raise their money from, who their LPs are. And
yeah, as if in this environment, founder's going to be like, yeah, exactly. I can't take your money.
I'd rather my 50 employees, like, you know, end up on the street. I think this article is actually written by, interestingly, is written by an entrepreneur. But yeah, it's basically like, how far should we be digging into where VCs are raising their funds from? Whose responsibility is it to diligence the source of funds? Obviously, there's, you know, very serious issues at play here. Maybe we can discuss
this
in
next
the next
time.
Session.
Yeah. Well, I think we're running out of time.
If anyone has read it and they have thoughts or comments, drop them below and we'll read them before we do the next session.
Okay, yeah, let's wrap up, but that's a good one for next time, actually. So in terms of audience feedback, two bits of good feedback, no haters this time. So Gideon Lemmer said, great article, great summary, awesome work, ! That was good. He's a radiology doctor. And then Tommy Perkins, who's...
Thanks, Gideon.
A GP and co-founder of Medics Money said, I'm so addicted. I did notice that you missed last week. No pressure. The new intro is fire, basically.
It's really good.
From Medics Money, can he help us make some money through this podcast?
Yeah. Well, I'm broke. I don't know about you two. Adam looks rich, is what I'll say.
Adam lives in hotels. That's fine. Yeah,
he's always in a different hotel room. So I don't know.
No, but there were some really sweet like reposts of the content on LinkedIn that I saw. There were like a handful of them, actually, three reposts this time. A bunch of people, expressing their support and enjoyment of it, which is really good. It gives us like motivation and points us in the right direction as to what works.
Awesome. All right, guys.
I think it was because Adam wasn't there last time, actually, that people really enjoyed it.
There's better rapport, I think.
Yeah, more empathy. There's more empathy in the conversation. Less empathy, I should say. No, Adia, yeah. Less empathy. Where are you, Adam?
I'm in Dubai.
And how did you get such a big microphone through airport security?
it's because he passes as white, so he can get through that. He can get randomly selected.
What's your name, sir? Adam. Sorry. Adam what?
Yeah, Adam, the keys to the cockpit. Yeah.
My name's Adam Paterno.
Yeah, Adam, are you? Do you consider yourself like Arab, white? Yeah. Like, what's your identity?
Well, I'm half Irish, half Jordanian, so I consider I'm like Muslim, so consider myself more like Arab Muslim than Irish, to be honest.
Very good. Guys, we'll do this again soon. This was fun.
All right.
See you later. Bye.
Ciao. Bye.